America.
Wake up, America!
Wake up, America. It's time for Michael Dean After Dark. I'm your host, Michael Dean, Freedom Fiend, and this is the Late Night Feisty Liberty Show. We have a rotating stable of interesting insomniac co-hosts. Plus, we leave the phone lines open. So if the hamster in your brain is keeping you up, please call in. This is Michael Dean, and it's Michael Dean After Dark. And you should not be listening to what that guy just said. That guy that was just talking, he's lying, because tonight we're doing something different, and we are not having the phone lines open. We are not taking calls. About eight or nine years ago, I wrote this book called $30 Film School. And about 7 years ago, this guy named Anamitra Roy from India contacted me and said that he'd found my book. It's a printed book. Like, you can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it in bookstores. I write books for a living. It's one of the things I do. He said that somebody put it on Pirate Bay, and he found it and read a scan of it and really liked it, and it influenced his filmmaking. And he wanted to interview me for something for a magazine he was writing. And I'm like, ugh. I just finished writing my second long 500-page book. I don't want to write. And he's like, well, you do a podcast. Why don't we just – you can interview – I'll interview you on the podcast, and then I'll transcribe it. And I was like, great. So this other guy recently, who's friends of his, contacted me. This guy named Andreas Siege. I'm probably saying that wrong, but it's like the coolest real name I've ever heard. That's not a made-up name. Nope. Was that good?
Yeah.
Contacted me from Germany, who's working, he's interviewing that guy, Anamitra Roy, and a bunch of other filmmakers, and they wanted to interview me, and I was like, I hate writing, I do it all the time, I don't like typing, and they're like, and Anamitra suggested the same thing. So tonight we're doing something completely different. Andreas is going to interview me, and it's going to be the episode for tonight. He's going to interview me about independent filmmaking. And it's also useful for anybody who does art independently of any kind. You'll learn some things that are useful about getting out in the world and getting heard and getting seen and maybe making a few dollars here and there or not. And so, Andreas, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're calling from Germany, right?
That's right. I'm calling from Germany, from Frankfurt.
Frankfurt. Thank you. So tell me a little about you and your web address and what you do and what your company is.
Right. So I have a small micro-budget film company called Kalulu Entertainment, and our website is kaluluentertainment.com. We've made two feature-length movies so far, both set and shot in Ethiopia. Right now, the first is being sent off to film festivals, which is a science fiction film about... Well, actually, I'm not going to get into what it's about because that takes. Because right now, what we're working on is a book as well about DIY filmmaking advice, and that's what I'm going to ask you some questions about. And thank you very much for being open to doing this. This is great.
Yeah, man. What's your web address?
My web address is kaluluentertainment.com. Kalulu is Kalulu, and that's the name of an African rabbit who was actually the grandfather of Bugs Bunny. And so, what that means is, all over Africa, there's these stories about this rabbit, this trickster that tricks all these other animals. And back in the day, this rabbit was brought over to the U.S. mostly by the slaves, and was turned, and this rabbit became the Uncle Remus stories. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
Yeah.
And the Uncle Remus stories about this rabbit were then later reinterpreted by other African American authors like Zora Neale Hurston and so on, and eventually they became Bugs Bunny.
Cool. What's your first question for me?
Okay, so the first question is, what is the most important advice that you have for someone who wants to make a DIY film?
Okay, now I'm gonna also have you ask it in German, because you see your English is so good that people aren't going to believe you're actually German. So ask me again in German, and then I'll answer it. in English.
Okay. Was ist der wichtigste Rat, den du für jemanden hast, der einen DIY-Film drehen will?
I like how DIY is DIY in German. Yeah. Okay. Well, there's no word. Important advice for making a DIY film. I guess the first thing would be don't listen to anybody else. And then the second thing would be listen to everybody, which it sounds very contradictory. But basically what I mean by that is don't be afraid to ask advice on anything in life from people who've gone down the path you're planning on going down. But also don't be afraid to not take that advice. Be willing to not take the advice, because a lot of people in film have very rigid ideas, in any art, have very rigid ideas about how to do it, and they know what worked for them, or they know what their professor said, or they know what they read somewhere, and you'd never really find usable shortcuts that aren't even shortcuts, just easier ways of doing things or different new ways of doing things if you're not willing to experiment. And doing digital film has gotten so cheap that you can afford to make mistakes. It was very hard to experiment in filmmaking when you had to use actual film. When you were every minute you were shooting film, you were thinking about how many dollars or Deutschmarks it cost per minute to buy the film and develop it. But now it's practically free. You know, you have a camera, you can do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen movies that are shot on cell phones. You know, cell phones now have high def cameras in them, like a good Android phone or a good iPhone. My friend Derek J, who I think you're going to be talking to for your book too, he made a film called Victimless Crime Spree, which is largely him getting arrested for doing things that should not be a crime, like basically walking into a public government building filming, or you know, smoking a joint in a public park, or basically doing things on public property that don't harm anybody, you know, when they're really everything in my mind should be probably private property. But that's another discussion. But, you know, a lot of that film is shot on a variety of cameras, and really in a thing like that, an activist kind of film like that, the camera it's less about filmmaking and more about the camera is a witness to what's happening. You know, like you ever notice on the news, they will show the lowest resolution, grainiest cell phone footage that you've ever seen of some historic event, if it's the only footage of it happening. You know, they don't care about the quality of the film. It's the quality of the fact that there was a witness there and it was a camera. So, and then they took a lot of that footage, and some of it was shot on better cameras, and then there were some interviews done on really good cameras afterwards, and then they took a lot of time editing it and did a good job with the presentation. But, you know, it's what I would say also is just get out there and do it. You know, when I was I started making films on Super 8 way before video. I'll be 50 years old soon, and I started making films in about 1978, you know, when I was about 14, 15, 78, 79. And, you know, I had to think about the money it took to make a film. And I was not from a rich family, and I had to buy my own film. And it was, I don't remember how much it was, but my memory of it is it probably worked out to, in modern money, you know, in money now, it probably worked out to about $2 a minute for the film and the processing. You know, it was very expensive, so I had to really think about what I was doing, but I did it anyway. You know, I didn't even own a camera. And when I made my first film, DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist, that was made in 2001. It was actually shot in 2000. I didn't own a camera either, because back then, you know, even standard definition video cameras were like $2,500 to like $5,000. And I didn't have one. I didn't know anybody who had one either. So what I did, I had an idea for a film, and I went around the corner there was an art college. I always saw the kids out front smoking cigarettes on their breaks. And I just walked up to them and said, "Who's in the film school here?" Until I found someone who was. Mm-hmm. And explained my idea and said, "Hey, I can't pay you, but I'll feed you lunch and buy you beer at the end of the day, and you'll get a credit and a copy of the movie." And they're like, "Okay," because what they were doing in film school then, that was when they were still having to shoot on film and having to think about the dollars per minute of it. And they didn't let you make a film in film school until like the third year of it. You know, they didn't let you make a film that was more than, you know, 5 minutes long, because first of all, the expense of it. And second of all, because that's how colleges work. They do it at a very slow rate, a methodical rate. And I've had people read my $30 film school book. Many people, if you read the reviews on Amazon, many, many people's reviews of it are, I wish I'd read this book. I would have saved $100,000 on 3 years of film school. So I guess another thing I would say for people who want to get into DIY film is to go buy my book, DIY $30 Film School, and watch my movies and read your book when it comes out.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, just go out and do it. I feel the same way. Totally. What's the second most important advice that you have for people?
Don't ask for permission. You know, okay. Don't, I mean, you know, here's an example. Like I lived in LA for a few years, and I did not move there to make movies. I actually started making films in San Francisco, and rent got too expensive to where I couldn't afford even a small apartment in San Francisco. So I moved to LA. It's cheaper. And I didn't go out and try to meet people or try to sell a screenplay or try to network or anything like that. I just kept working on films, you know, at home and out in the street and with other people. And I knew a lot of people who were trying to go through the Hollywood route, which is basically asking permission. You know, either you go to film school and then you get a job at Sony or Warner Brothers, you know, bringing the coffee to people, you know, like you don't, you probably don't end up being a filmmaker. I mean, there's a tiny, tiny, tiny chance that you'll end up being a big, successful, talented, well-paid, you know, millionaire filmmaker. But there's a much bigger chance if you're talented that if you do it your own, you can make things that are powerful, get them seen, and make a little bit of money at it. We'll be back with more on Michael Dean After Dark after this trip to the market, talking about DIY filmmaking and art in general. Worms.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, the invigorating alternative to those other late night shows.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the Fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com. Groovy guys and groovy gals. This is Michael Dean. It's After Dark. And if the hamster in your brain is spinning out of control, you cannot call in because we are not taking calls tonight. We will ignore it if you call in, because tonight it's all about me, because I'm being interviewed for a DIY filmmaking book by Andreas Siege from Frankfurt. Is it Frankfurt? How do you say it?
Frankfurt.
Frankfurt, yes. And here we are on Radio 100 in Berlin. No, that's the only... I was interviewed on a station once called Radio 100 in Berlin.
Oh, yeah.
It's Radio 100. I think it was Pirate. I don't know. But, all right, what's your next question there for me, sir?
So, what advice do you have for people who want to make a living doing what they love? I mean, it's one thing to make your movie, but then to make it sustainable. What advice do you have?
Don't make films. Join the army instead. I'm paraphrasing Frank Zappa. Somebody said, what advice do you have for young musicians? And he said, I think they should all quit immediately. And then I think somebody else said, join the army. You'll always have a job, which is not a recommendation I make at all.
It's true though, but yeah.
Were you in the army in Germany? Do you have to go still?
No, not anymore. Yeah.
What do you do now to not go to the army?
Well, they completely got rid of it. It used to be that you could choose to either do community service or go to the army, but now they've gotten rid of that choice as well. So
now that the army, now that they have drones, they don't need soldiers.
Yeah, pretty much.
Do you guys have drones? Does your country have drones?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Okay. So I don't really know.
So no. What's your next question? Did you ask it yet? I just kept talking. I forget. What was it?
What advice do you have for people who want to make a living doing what they love, to make it sustainable?
Well, you should not be making art if you plan to make a living at it, because chances are you will not. Or if you do, chances are you'll starve and your children will starve and be barefoot and your wife will leave you because you're broke. And I guess I'd say choose good people to be around. My wife won't leave me. She didn't leave. She met me when I was broke, and now I'm not broke. And it's all still good. You know, she loves me and loves art. Let's see. I would say don't do anything to try to make a living. I'm not saying like don't try to make money. I'm saying like don't ever plan things to make money. You know, when you're making your film, make it as good as possible and then try to find a market for it. I would also say this is something I've kind of done intuitively, but it might be something that people could do in a planned way, is try to find a film that doesn't exist and make it. Find a niche that is not filled at all, that's completely empty. Instead of trying to, you know, like make a kind of film that there's a lot of already, try to make your own one. You know, I mean, you're trying to interview the guy who did Blair Witch Project. Like, that film did not exist, and all of a sudden everyone was trying to make films like it. They shouldn't have been trying to make films like it. They should have been trying to come up with their own thing that was just as cool and weird and different. And I
great example.
Yeah. What's that?
Blair Witch is a great example. Totally.
Yeah. You know, and I don't think the actors in it made much money at all. They got paid a little bit of money, but I interviewed Josh Leonard from that film in my book, $30 Film School. And, he's getting work in Hollywood now. I see him pop up on television once in a while, but not that often. And the other two people, I don't think they've ever been in a film since then. But, yeah, the guy who made it went on to make some other things. I think Hollywood paid him to try to make a sequel to it, and they bought the rights to it and messed with the formula and tried to make it into something really Hollywood, and it didn't work. And I've never even seen more than 2 minutes of that second film. It wasn't very good.
No, it wasn't found footage either.
Yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't presented at it either, as it either. So yeah, I would say like my film DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist, I didn't even decide I wanted to, you know, it wasn't like I was a young filmmaker and said, that's the film I'm going to make. It's the other way around. I actually had never made a film, and I had such a clear picture in my mind of the film that had to be made that I learned filmmaking to do it. I mean, I actually considered, you know, I could write already. I was thinking maybe this should be a book of interviews, or maybe it should be a play, or maybe it should be a photo exhibit. You know, it's kind of like the way I get tattoos. I don't have a lot of tattoos, but the ones I have are very personal, and nobody else in the world has, at least 3 of my 5 tattoos, nobody else in the world has the same tattoo. And yeah, man, I would say start with what you want to do and do it rather than being influenced by what anyone else is doing. I'll have more when we come back from this trip to the market.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark. And yes, we're broadcasting this message into space. Meowbit is free software from the Freedom Fiends that allows you to effortlessly view .bit websites. Meowbit works on all browsers. .bit is a new type of web address that's not controlled by any government or corporation. And we'll show you how to register a .bit domain today using a few cents worth of Namecoin. If anyone ever shuts down your .com website, users will still be able to get to your site using your .bit address and our free software, Meowbit. Go to meowbit.com. That's meowbit.com. Hold your kitties tight. It's a warm night in Wyoming. It's been really cold lately, but suddenly, all of a sudden, it was... I had windows open in the house today. It was pretty amazing. This is Michael Dean After Dark, and I'm talking with Andreas Siege. Are you there, Andreas?
Yep, I'm here.
Cool. I think I'm gonna talk more on your. I guess the question was something else, but it's kind of turned into how do you make money at filmmaking. And another thing I'd say is the corollary to my previous advice of, you know, never compromise. Don't ask. Don't care what other people think. Do your own thing. Would be, I have a different set of rules for myself for that when working for other people. Now, you can make, you know, a lot of people that make independent film, even independent film that a lot of people see, don't make enough money at it to live, at least not for many years. You know, they might have one kind of commercially successful film, but it's hard to sustain that. And if you're doing things on the side with related skills, don't try to put too much of yourself into it unless you're such a name that people are hiring you as a name. Like, for instance, my co-host on the Freedom Fiends, my other show on this network on the weekends, he does wedding videography and he's a wedding DJ. Now, he is a hip hop musician who's really, really good at what he does, and he can DJ, you know, he could win a DJ contest. He makes records that are great where he does scratching and he does mixing. And plays his own music and plays keyboards and programs drum machines. But when he goes to do someone's wedding, he doesn't do that. You know, he's not the star. He realizes this is the most important day of someone, two other people's lives. It's not about him. They don't care who the DJ is, as long as the DJ plays the music they ask for and, you know, has good transitions between songs. So it's not about him. And the same thing when he does videography for weddings. You know, he's a great filmmaker. He and I made a film together called Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. And it's a pretty amazing movie for the low budget. It's a $2,500 budget. It's a feature-length, high-def, 99-minute film that's got DVD distribution and has been in a bunch of film festivals. And a lot of people have downloaded it and watched it on YouTube. And we made money at it. But he doesn't try to put himself into the videography. He just tries to make something that's really high quality, really well lit, really well framed, captures the essence of it, but doesn't present himself in it. He doesn't try to put his trademark on it. And that's a success tip to surviving at your chosen field of art, whatever it is, without compromising. You know, I don't consider doing that compromising. Like, sometimes people hire my wife or myself to record voiceover for their, you know, their radio ads or something, or, you know, for their answering machine message, or for an industrial, you know, for like a corporation making, you know, like a DVD, like, welcome new employees, here's what you do, that kind of stuff. And we don't try to do any tricks or make it really cool or make it psychedelic or any of the kind of stuff I would do on my own radio show. We just do what the client wants and try to get along with them really well and try to deliver it on budget, on time, or before time, and do a really good job and be willing to redo something if they want it done a little differently. And, you know, usually I'll give them a draft of something before I do the final thing so they can make the changes and I don't have to make the whole, I can make the changes without having to do the whole project over. You know, people that do work for other people in any kind of medium like that, like filmmaking or photography for pay, you know, if you had someone's skill level rated on a scale of 1 to 10 and somebody's ability to get along with other people rated on 1 to 10, the person who's going to be the most employed at it is the person who their ability to get along with other people is 10 out of 10 and their talent is 5 out of 10. Over, they're going to get more work than the person whose talent is 10 out of 10 and their ability to get along with people is 5 out of 10. You know, it's like Albert Einstein worked for the patent office, you know. I mean, he had one of the most mundane, lowly jobs in the world, and he didn't try to put himself into it, you know. You gotta put food on your table. You got to take care of your family. If you're going to be an artist and not deliver pizzas, you know, if you want to do something connected to your art, you have to be able to separate you from the art and even separate the art from the mechanics of it when you're doing stuff for pay for people and they have an idea of what they want.
I think that's a really, really important point. You're saying, of course, and I agree, don't ask for permission, but don't be difficult when you're working with other people.
Well, it's well. I'm talking about two different things. The don't ask for permission is when you are making your film.
Exactly.
When you're working for somebody else, you should absolutely ask permission. If you want to do something weird in their wedding video, you should ask them. And you probably shouldn't even ask them because you probably shouldn't do something weird in their wedding video. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So the next question is, what was the biggest obstacle you faced when making your first film?
Money and the fact that nobody knew who I was. So there was no, I had to convince people to cooperate. And they didn't know me from anybody on the street. Now that I've made a few films and done some other things in some other worlds of art, I still, you know, I can call people up and say, oh, I want to interview you for this film. I made these other films, and they might have heard of the other films, and it opens doors for me. But that's not universally true, too. And I mean, I'm 50 years old, and a lot of what I do is still introducing myself to people and saying, here's why you should check out what I'm doing. Like, to be on these radio stations, I have to call, you know, to get on one station, I have to call about 100 stations. You know, I have to call them up, introduce them myself. They have to like talking to me. They have to find time to talk to me. I have to actually get them on the phone because they're busy people too. And, you know, they have 50 people a day calling them and saying, my radio show is the best radio show in the world. You should put us on. And it's even harder than you'd think. It's harder than, like, oh, let's say booking a band in clubs, because clubs that have music always have slots to fill in the future. You know, if they're a really popular club, they might be booked 4 months in advance, but they have spaces available in the future. Whereas radio, talk radio, it's already booked. Every station in America that has talk radio, it already has a show in every slot 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So you have to also find someone who is either unhappy with a show that they're playing, or is, you know, somebody's going to retire, or the somebody got fired or something. So you have to, like, wait around for those spots. So I'm 50 years old and I'm making my way in a new field now that I've only been in for a couple of years. And none of these people know who I am. And I'm having to introduce myself and say hi every day. And it's very frustrating because when I was, you know, before I made films, I was in a rock band and I was signed to Warner Brothers, and we toured America 6 times and we toured Europe once. And, you know, it was cool. We made some great music and I did make a little bit of money at it. But I really thought that by the time I was 50, I would either be dead or immensely rich and famous. And I am neither dead nor immensely rich and famous. So, you know, my teenage fantasies of using my art to pave my way for the rest of my life, it's not like that. And this is, I think, is the biggest lesson for any independent artist doing anything out there, is that you have to never rest on your laurels, never rest on the past, never say, you know, I've made it. Never look at it as one person is going to come along and wave their magic wand and make you what you want to be. It's not a single event. It's a lifetime of tiny events.
You got to do it yourself as well.
Yeah, do it yourself. But also I would say, don't turn down help from people who, I mean, do it yourself doesn't mean do it alone, I guess is what I'm saying. And yes, I also think when I was younger, I had a very anti-capitalist attitude, and I grew out of that probably about the time I started making money, which some people would say, of course you did, you sold out. But I've never sold out. I've never compromised a single frame of any film I've ever done for somebody else. Here's what I think. I think that giant corporations and larger companies have a place in art, but it's not what it used to be. The place that it used to be is deciding who gets to make the movies. And I don't think that's their place anymore, and who gets to make the records. But I think that they're still really good at distributing things, even better than people doing it themselves and just throwing it up on iTunes or, you know, YouTube, or selling it, you know, with a post office box or whatever. I really think there are still companies out there that are really good at selling. They're not good at art. They don't know art when they see it. They could never make suggestions of what will make great art. But in And this will probably change in a few years. Those companies will probably completely go away and people will probably do it entirely themselves. But I like to make the complete product from start to finish the way I want it and then bring it to somebody who's really good at selling it. And I also think that it's not that important that the person selling it for you understands art or your vision. And a lot of young artists have a really hard time dealing with that. You know, they start dealing with someone who is a distributor for movies and they get the feeling that the people they're dealing with might as well be selling soap. You know, they don't care that it's a great movie. And that's not a bad thing. If somebody, you want somebody who doesn't care if it's soap or not, because they won't worry about the artistic integrity of it. You worry about that. You get it made and then you bring it to them and they can help you sell it. And if you can't get it sold by someone like that, you sell it just yourself, you know? And if you can't sell it, you give it away. And if it's good, the market will respond to it. And to me, that's true. That's true capitalism. Like what the capitalism has a really bad name because, with a lot of people, especially in Europe, because they conflate it with corporatism. Corporatism is capitalism combined with government, controls, with a government picking winners and losers. And that is not capitalism. True capitalism is, you know, anything from you set up a stand on the corner and start selling fruit to a successful company. I mean, it's hard to name a company that I would consider truly capitalist because any large company in the world right now is subject to regulations and taxes and things of governments. But, you know, I think you can be a millionaire and not be evil. I do not think you can be 100 millionaire and not be evil, but you know, there's nothing wrong with success. It allows you to make more art and keep doing what you're doing without having to grind yourself down with a day job. We'll be back with more after this trip to the free market.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, and I'm speaking directly to you. Yes, you.
Creamy Radio Audio. Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark. And our guest tonight is me, Michael Dean, on Michael Dean After Dark. And interviewing me is Andreas, who is my new friend from Frankfurt, the fort of Frank in Germany. And he's interviewing me for a book. And this is going to be what's in the book. So what is your next question, sir?
So you said earlier when answering one of the other questions, and I'd like to follow up on it.
Yeah,
if it's good, it will sell. Can you elaborate on that? Because I think that's a very important point.
Yeah, it's more accurate to say if there's a market for it, it will sell. And to me, that helps define good. And it's really hard for me to say that because most things that are very popular, I feel, are very horrible. You know, there is music out there that has 154 million views on YouTube that I'm just like, that's not music, which is kind of bizarre because, you know, I think every generation makes music that the previous generation thinks that's not music. And that even predates rock and roll. But, you know, in the early 80s, I was really into punk rock and played in punk rock bands. And I knew people who were just a couple years older than me that grew up listening to Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin. And they were like, that is not music, what you're listening to, man. The Sex Pistols and The Clash are not music. But I like the Sex Pistols, The Clash, and Minor Threat, and really abrasive, even like less musical stuff than that. And I like Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin, and I think it's all music. And I like, you know, I like hip hop. I like NWA. I like Ice Cube. And I heard some hip hop the other day. I like Ice-T. And I heard some hip hop the other day that I was just like, this is not music, man. I don't know what this is. And 154 million people like this. And, you know, because like hip hop basically strips things down to a beat and a hook. Like there doesn't even have to be melody, but there has to be a hook. And I heard some music that's incredibly popular that doesn't even have a hook. It doesn't even have like one line repeated that's catchy. And I just didn't understand it. I was like, what are these kids up to these days? But, you know,
but it's important that you're saying
somebody likes it. You know, it sells because it touches a nerve with a bunch of people. So that's good. And I really, I think that there's a lot of people who think that since they are good people and think deep thoughts, they're somebody, you know, if the world will love what they make. And that's not necessarily true. I would say that if you make something and nobody outside your family and friends likes it, you're doing it wrong and you need to rethink how you're presenting it. It might be a unique idea. If you have a completely unique idea but don't present it in a way that's appealing in some way to people, they're not going to watch it. They're not going to listen to it. So good is very subjective. I guess if it's good, it will sell. I have to explain good as if it is good to people, it'll sell. And and I don't even necessarily mean sell. I mean, get views on YouTube for free. If it's good, somebody will like it and watch it and tell their friends to like it and watch it.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So the next question for you is, what were your personal motivations for making your first film?
Well, my motivations for making every film I've ever done have been the same as my motivations for making every piece of art I've ever done, because I'm, I guess what you'd call a multidisciplinarian artist. You know, I'm a filmmaker, I'm a musician, I'm a photographer, I'm a writer, and I guess everybody is all those things now that you can do it all on computers really easily. But I guess I would say I've been slightly commercially successful at all of those things, except for photography. You know, I've been in a band that's, you know, I've sold about 30,000 records of bands I've been on, records and CDs and cassettes. I've, you know, made 5 films that all have distribution. I've written 10 books, you know, some of them are self-published, some of them are on major publishers. And so I've done it myself, but I've done it in conjunction with other people. We'll have more on this after the, in the second hour. And here's the part I want you to listen to.
Michael Dean After Dark. Go to michaelwdean.com. That's michaelwdean.com.
Good evening, my fellow
worms. I know some things you don't know.
I'll be back with more later on.
I'm never satisfied.
This is Michael Dean After Dark.
The stato sperimentato.
We have a
rock and roll
pessimism.
The United States government presents
no vision.
Not having enough money.
The power was so great.
Estos por su parte consideran
to provide guidance to mankind.
Go to michaelwdean.com for more. That's michaelwdean.com. We'll be back for hour two after this trip to the market on Michael Dean After Dark.
Bye for now.
Love the Fiends and want to help out? We do take donations and we put them back into our Liberty Projects. You can make a donation by clicking on the spinning coin on any post. But what if you want to help, but you ain't got no cash? Or you made a donation and you want to help more? Here's how you can help. Download and seed our torrents to help keep us drone-proof. There's a Torrent Club link at the top of freedomfiends.com. You can also blog the Fiends and share episode links on Facebook, Twitter, and elsewhere. You can rate and review our movies on Amazon and IMDb. You can rate and review the Freedom Fiends and our songs on iTunes. That really helps a lot. You can buy our movies and share them with friends or give them out as gifts. And one of the best ways to spread liberty is to buy a bunch of Freedom Fiends buttons and give them out as gifts. Wholesale prices are available, and you can also comment on our site, or better yet, comment about us on other sites, and please email the site link to all your friends. Thanks for helping spread the Fiend's message worldwide to as many Liberty people as you can, especially to those who don't yet get it. You rock.
Yep. Uh-huh. This is hour two. Hour two of two of Michael Dean After Dark. And our guest tonight is Michael Dean. That's me. And I'm happily filling out a questionnaire. And it didn't come from the government, so I will do a private census for free. That's more fun than a census for the government. I actually filled out the census for the government, but I felt kind of poked while I did it. So I did it anyway. You got to choose your battles. So yeah, this is Michael Dean, and I'm being interviewed by Andrea Siege from Frankfurt. Say it again.
Frankfurt.
Yes. There's actually a town called that in Tennessee here, but it's spelled a little differently, but you know.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Yeah. Lots of German people.
Oh, no, it's Kentucky, and we're actually on the radio in Kentucky. We're on one radio station with the show. It's in Cairo, Illinois, which is on the border of Kentucky, and it reaches into Paducah, Kentucky. I don't think it reaches quite to Frankfurt. Mm-hmm. Frankfurt, as the Americans probably say it, Frankfurt, yeah. Kentucky. But so we're going to continue the questioning. I'm under the bright lights being questioned here in the libertarian police station about my involvement with making underground activist DIY films. What was your question? I didn't finish answering it. What was your question at the end of the first hour?
That's right. The question at the end of the first hour was, what were your personal motivations for making your first film?
Chicks, man. I would say there is in any art that I make, I can only speak for myself. My motivations for art. I mean, there is always something about approval. People who claim that they only play music for the love of playing music. If that was true and they didn't care about the approval of the audience, they wouldn't bother writing songs that have verses and choruses and lyrics, because it's a lot more fun to just noodle on a guitar than it is to actually work on writing a song. So I would say that any artist who says that they only do it for the love of doing it and don't care about the audience, is either false or deluded or never going to have an audience.
Yeah.
There are people who are great artists who don't like the relationship that they have to have with the industry and with the artist. I mean, and with the audience, but they do it anyway. Like, for instance, Kurt Cobain, but I think he really enjoyed writing great songs, and he enjoyed probably people reacting to those songs, because, if you're a musician and you don't care about an audience, you'd never bother to book a gig. You would just stay in the garage and play. So, I would say that there's some aspect of wanting approval for it, which makes you put it into a sequence that people's brains can comprehend. But I would say the main thing that's motivated everything I've ever done creatively, whether it's a book or a film or a song or a radio show, is I'm making the art that does not yet exist. You know, I was in this band called Bomb. It was a really good band. But I swear that if that band had already existed, I would have been their sound man instead. I would have been happy to help that band in any way, because it was the music that I wanted to hear that did not exist in the world. And this radio show is very different from all the other radio shows in America. We're not spending our time talking about what's wrong with, you know, the president and why we need to get a different president. When we talk about politics on the show, we talk about why all the presidents are evil and why we don't need a president. But it's very different from what's on most talk radio in America. It's not angry. It's happy. It's upbeat. Even when we're complaining about things, we're upbeat. And it's basically the talk radio I wanted to hear. And I guess you could say I love the sound of my own voice, and that's true of everything I do. I mean, I watch the movies I make. You know, I watch them a million times while I'm editing them. But then after they're done and out, I usually move on to my next project, but then I really like to go back a year later and watch it and actually enjoy it fully for the first time, seeing it as an audience rather than as a creator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
What's next?
The next question is, how do you define DIY film?
And your follow-up here is, how is it different from traditional filmmaking? I'm going to answer both of those at the same time.
Okay.
DIY is very much a buzzword these days. You know, it's something that it stands for do-it-yourself, and it means different things different places. Like in England, DIY, it also means what we're talking about, but it means a hardware store, a do-it-yourself shop. You know, if you say, where's the DIY shop? It means, where's the hardware store? I want to buy a hammer and some nails, you know, or some paint. But to me, the term do-it-yourself, DIY or die, is the term that I first heard. And I first heard that in about 1986, and it was a punk rock slogan. And it basically meant, if you don't put out your own records, nobody's going to bother to put out your records because they're too weird, you know. And then it kind of changed to where, like, punk rock became kind of mainstream, and you have, you know, people like The Clash came along who had, you know, were in the top 10, and then you had you know, stuff like Green Day who were in the number one slot, and it became a big business. But to me, when that happened, that didn't kill punk rock for me, but it was kind of time for the next chapter in my life, which was going on to other art forms that I had not yet conquered. You know, I got into filmmaking and I got into computers and then I got into radio. I've wanted to be on radio since I was 5. I mean, that was like the first thing I ever wanted to do. I think I wanted to be a disc jockey on a music station, you know, who talked between the records and said cool stuff, because talk radio didn't really exist when I was 5 or 6 or 7 in the way it does now. But, Yeah. So DIY, I mean, some people would say it means a budget cutoff, you know, like in Hollywood, you know, it's kind of interchangeable too, I think, with independent, and the lines of what's independent film is very blurry now in the Hollywood system, because there are, you know, independent movie used to mean, you know, made for a few thousand dollars, and now independent movie can not only mean a several, you know, $2 or $3 or $5 million budget. There are actually, technically, there are independent movies now that cost $100 million, because a lot of what I was talking about how, what's that?
Lord of the Rings is technically an independent film.
Yeah. Like the, you know, when a director gets so much recognition that he can basically call his own ticket and do what he wants. First of all, a lot of times Hollywood movie studios, you know, the big studios aren't really interested in doing that. They're like, we don't really care that you're Peter Jackson. We still want to have some say in the final cut of the movie. But even the directors that reach the point like Jackson has now, to where they say, yeah, do what you want. Tell us how many hundreds of millions of dollars you need and we'll give it to you. And you give us the movie when you're done, without any interference at all. It's still not economically that great of a deal. So what people like he will do is they'll, you know, mortgage a couple of their mansions and get a bank loan and get investors and literally make it independently and then take it and shop it to the highest bidder at the studios. So those movies are technically independent, but they're certainly not DIY. I would say any film that involves any union workers is not independent. You know, if someone's being paid union wage and having to go by union rules, I would say independent is down to the point where my real definition of DIY is like filming on the street, in a place that requires permits without getting permits. I would say that's the real definition of DIY. There's a lot of really brilliant filmmaking coming out now, and a lot of it just ends up on YouTube. And, you know, there was a time when people would have considered that a failure, but now it's kind of like people there. Why do I want to go to, you know, Moses on the mountain and beg his permission to be my distributor, you know, when I can just put it up tonight on YouTube? And there are DIY films on YouTube that have, you know, millions of hits. I have a video that I shot on YouTube that has about 400,000 views that I never even bothered to put ads on because I don't like ads. I'm not against ads on YouTube. I just don't like it. And, you know, I guess another thing I'd say is make everything you do of the highest quality you can, as if it's the only thing you're ever going to be remembered by, because you never know what's the thing that's going to get the most views, you know? And the thing that I made that has almost 400,000 views, I didn't plan it to be, you know, there's things that I've spent a lot more time on that got 500 views or 1,000 views. But this thing, part of the reason it got all the views is because it's good and it's something people want to see. But another reason is because I made really sure that the audio was really good. I made sure the color correction was good. I lit it well, and I edited it well. And it's very short. It's like 3 minutes long. But I actually, of all the comments I've gotten on it today, somebody I don't know commented on it and said, man, the audio is really great on this. And I was like, cool. So one person out of 400,000 noticed it and said it. But the other 400,000 people didn't know that to consciously think it and comment it, or, you know, maybe some of them did, but didn't bother. But it's a comment that had not come up before, but it wouldn't have that many views if it had bad audio, because the fact that it had good audio made it more watchable and more listenable to people, you know. And actually, audio is a very important part of film. It's, I've said before, and I still believe this, I said this like 10 years ago, that the quality of audio in a video is more important than the quality of the video in a video, because people are used to, you know, kind of grungy looking video because it's almost an effect now, like handheld, like even before Blair Witch Project, but especially after that, people are really used to seeing kind of, they consider it kind of arty and kind of an effect to have something handheld and blurry and moving around a lot or dark or moody. But if the audio is really good, they'll be more accepting of that without even thinking about it.
Yeah. That's a really good point.
So what's next? Audio is
really important.
I'm trying to think if I've finished, what are my personal motivations for making my first film? I guess I would say it's the same of making every piece of art in any medium I've ever made. And it's to make something that I want to see or hear that hasn't been done yet. And then everything else, like acceptance and money and any kind of personal satisfaction and making friends, all of that, or even having a message, all of that is secondary. But the message is why I do it, so.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum. You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech is hate speech, guns and weed, buy sheep for sheep on sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists.
It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
This is Michael Dean After Dark. And tonight we're having a very special occasion. It's very different from most nights at Michael Dean After Dark. It's the DIY Film School, and I'm answering questions that are going to go into a book by Andreas Siege from Frankfurt, Germany. All right, what's your next question? What's your next question, sir?
So please answer. Who was your biggest inspiration for making your movies? When you started, I mean.
Yeah. Probably not filmmakers, probably punk rock musicians, because probably the band Minor Threat, because they had a very successful is a hard to define word, but they made great music that I loved. They turned down offers from major labels, offering them a lot of money. They ran a record label. They still run Discord Records out of their house, and then it got too big to run in their house. So they first rented and then bought the basement underneath the 7-Eleven convenience store across the street. And I really liked his attitude a lot. He would give the same amount of time for an interview. Ian MacKay would give the same amount of time for an interview for a national magazine or international magazine with millions of readers. He would give the same amount of time and care to like a 14-year-old kid with a broken tape recorder trying to interview him for a fanzine he was publishing in his bedroom. And I really thought that was cool. But filmmakers, I really liked Richard Kern. I met him, hung out with him in San Francisco. He was a good guy, and he made really dark, weird films on Super 8 in New York City in the 70s and 80s. And didn't care if he had an audience, but he got an audience, and I thought that was really cool. I really liked his attitude. I've always kind of liked people that had a maverick attitude of like, I don't care what you think, I just do it. Although, like I said, I think all people who do that, they don't care what any individual person thinks, and the people I respect are generally also making the art they want to see. But they also are making something that turns out that people like it. And Richard Kern didn't make a lot of money at his films, especially at first. He later, you know, after he stopped making film and moved on to photography only, his films were released on DVD by the same company that releases my films, MVD. It's music video distributors, but not everything they do is music. And they've put out 4 of my DVDs, and they've treated me really well. And I like them. They have really simple contracts. It's like one page. They don't pay you anything up front, but you don't pay them anything. And they sell DVDs and they pay monthly. And I've made a lot of money with them over the years and never had to compromise. I finish films and then send them to them and say, do you want this? And most of the time they say, yeah. And that's the kind of people I like to deal with. So let's see. Richard Kern was very influential to me. I mean, I would have to say that a lot of big Hollywood filmmakers were very influential to me because, like, I don't know if this is like most people, but, you know, I was very influenced by film as a child and as a teenager. You know, I mean, the movie Jaws was a very important movie to me when I was a kid. I saw it when I was 12 when it came out, and it scared the hell out of me. And I was like, I want to see it again. That was so weird. I want to see it again. But it had a good story. It was well done. You know, Spielberg, yeah. I liked Star Wars when it came out. You know, I think that anybody who says, when asked who their influences are, if anybody only names independent people, they're probably lying, because the first things most people see are not independent. The first things most people see are probably studio product, whether it's music or film or books or whatever. I mean, that's changing now because you have systems where people can directly at least give their stuff away to the world, if not sell it to the world easily. And you've kind of taken away the gatekeeper mechanism. I also think that a big influence for me on how I do filmmaking is the program BitTorrent. Because it literally not only enables you to, I don't use it for, you know, quote unquote, stealing other people's stuff, especially when there's something, well, let's say not anymore, especially now that there's something like Netflix where I can pay a little bit of money and see almost any film I want to see, without having to bother to do something. I think people use Netflix not because it's legal, but because it's easier than BitTorrent.
Yeah.
So, but I think BitTorrent, I use BitTorrent to release my art as well basically it keeps it around forever. Like, I don't even have to keep it on a website anymore because it's out there and it's on other people's servers, and I couldn't stop it if I wanted to. That's another thing of the market, you know, the demand for something dealing with how long it's around.
Want to contribute to Liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes and DVDs to help keep us drone-proof. There's a Torrent Club link at the top of freedomfiends.com. There you'll find our Torrent RSS feed and instructions to grab past episodes and automatically download new ones, even while you're away from the computer. You'll also get special episodes of The Fiends days or even weeks before regular podcast subscribers who aren't torrenting. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding The Fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down.
This is Michael Dean. It's Michael Dean After Dark. And I'm very much enjoying myself tonight because I am under the microscope. I am being dissected. My brain is attached to a board with pins, and we're slicing it open to find out what's inside it. Which is, you get a lot of my personality when I do a show on here, but I wouldn't say I'm evasive, but I kind of joke around a lot and kind of use a lot of sarcasm, and I'm not using any. I am truthfully, directly answering every question tonight, and they are meaningful questions from my buddy Andreas Siege from Frankfurt. So what's your next question there, Andreas?
Thank you for answering the questions. The next question is, why is the DIY film movement important?
Well, I don't personally consider myself a part of a movement, and I've never been interested in collectivizing myself around a medium, like on my wife and I, for our first anniversary, we went to a podcasting expo, which is an interesting thing. It was when podcasting was pretty new. It was in 2006. And I jumped on podcasting as soon as I heard about it. I was like, wait, what? You can make radio shows on your computer? And what? I want to do that. And immediately, I didn't even have a good microphone, and I started podcasting. And a week later, I got a good microphone because I was just, I have to do this right now because I've wanted to be able to talk to the world from my home my whole life. So I jumped on it. But I went to a podcasting expo, and a lot of people had a lot of fun there, and I'm not going to say anything bad about it, but I thought it was silly. I was like, all these people are going around the banner of something that is just technological, it's like it's not that high of a learning curve. You can basically learn how to do podcasting in about a day if you read on the internet and have a good ear and know what you're doing. So I didn't get anything out of being in that group. And I've spoken at a lot of filmmaking events. I've shown films at them and been an invited speaker. I've been to, major film festivals, or I've been flown to France, and I've also done things where, it's in someone's home, or it's in a bar, or it's in a church basement, or, it's in a youth center, and they feed me and pay me my gas money, and I sleep on the floor, or I do it for free, or I paid my gas money to go do it. And I really don't know, filmmakers as a group are boring to me in the same way that musicians as a group are boring to me. Most musicians are shallow, stupid people with very limited talent, and they're just recycling what other people have done. 95% of the punk bands that my band played with when I was in Bomb and touring the world, 95% of them sounded almost exactly like a fourth-rate copy of Iggy and the Stooges, or a fourth-rate copy of Dead Kennedys or Minor Threat. And very, very rarely did I even like any of them. But when I liked the few that were great and stood out, man, I still listen to them. They blew me away, and they're etched into my memory. And that's the same thing with filmmaking. I really like the technological changes that have happened in my lifetime, because DIY has become a reality in everything. Like, I started making film on film, where it cost money. I started doing photography on film, where I would have to go into a dark room and develop it myself, or take it somewhere and pay to have it developed. I recorded a number of records on independent labels, on my own labels, and on a major label, where you had to go into a recording studio that was, you know, $1 million worth of equipment and pay someone $300 an hour to record it. The resources were very limited back then, and technology and computers, and I would say the good aspects of globalization. There are bad aspects of it for sure, but the good aspects of it, to where, like, it used to be you could not buy a condenser microphone that sounded good without spending less than $5,000. You can buy a condenser microphone that's made in China that's a copy of those good microphones that sounds pretty good, not as good as the $5,000 ones, but you can buy it for $100 now. And the same thing with filmmaking. Like, when I started making film, you know, I was shooting on Super 8. It did not have sound. You had to record sound separately if you wanted it. You had to sync the sound yourself. And then digital cameras came along. Digital, you know, deep mini DV cameras were just revolutionary. I mean, it blew things away. But nobody really made any major films on them because they were so low resolution. I mean, you know, 480 by 720 is tiny compared to the resolution you get even from 16 millimeter films. 16 millimeter looks better. 8 millimeter has more resolution, let alone, you know, 35 millimeter, which is what most Hollywood movies were shot on back then. So it was kind of like training wheels on a bicycle. It was like, okay, you can shoot with digital film, and then maybe someday you'll be good enough that someone will lend you some money to make film on film. But then something happened was that within a few years, the prices went down to where, like, my last film was shot on a high def camera that can shoot a really good image that has sound, you know, records sound on it with a good external mic. I mean, I paid $500 for the camera, and you could probably, that was 2 years ago. You could probably get them cheaper now. It was 3 years ago. And it's gotten to the point where, like, everything that Hollywood makes, almost everything they make, is shot on digital. I mean, they're shot on those Red cameras that cost about $40,000 each, but even without the lens sets. But that's way cheaper than a Panaflex 35mm camera. I mean, those cameras, you can't buy one. You can only rent them. They have the whole system locked down, and they're worth more than a Ferrari. And you have to, like, hire, you have to pay insurance to rent one, and you have to have an armed guard that you're paying on the set to guard it from thieves. I mean, that's how expensive Hollywood filmmaking is with the old way. And it's gotten to the point where, like, everything on TV and a lot of things in movie theaters made from, you know, big Hollywood studios are shot on digital cameras that, if I couldn't buy one, I could certainly rent one for a week. You know, somebody once said, it was some famous French New Wave filmmaker, I forget which one, but one of them said that filmmaking will only become a true art when the materials are as cheap as pencil and paper. And I think we've basically got to that point where everybody has a high def camera on their phone in their pocket. They may have never even used it, but we're all walking around with high def cameras in our pocket. So I guess the answer is, I don't see the DIY film movement as a thing, because there are so many people making DIY film who don't even, you know, they don't have a newsletter, they don't have meetings, they don't get together. But the idea of DIY art creation and distribution now, to where technology has gotten to the point where everybody has better equipment than Hollywood had 40 years ago. Everybody has better equipment than Hollywood had 40 years ago. I think that that's been great, because it's created a much larger pool of possible great people being involved in filmmaking. It also makes the competition a lot harder, because, you know, now every film festival has, you know, 1,000 entries instead of 100, and everybody considers himself a filmmaker, or way more people than used to. You know, there's a lot more competition to get seen, but I think that's a really good thing, because, again, competition is the market. And when the market, the available pool of people competing to be seen is much larger, you're going to have a lot more just brilliant breakout people that can do stuff that never would have been seen otherwise, because they never would have had the money to get near a 35 millimeter camera, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Can we call it the DIY film phenomenon, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say that, I mean, it kind of started with the French New Wave, you know, in the 60s. I mean, a lot of those films were shot not on 35. They were shot on 16. They were shot by people who did not have permits. You know, they were running around the streets of Paris, you know, with real guns, pretending to shoot them or actually shooting them. I mean, they were nuts, those people. And they made films that, you know, some real stars came out of those films, and some not just real stars, but influencing a lot of people. I mean, a lot of filmmakers today are influenced by that kind of ideology and the filmmaking itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where do you see it going?
I'm kind of intrigued by, I think it's going to go, there's no limit to it except governments. I think the only interference is governments to any filmmaker ever. You know, I mean, you can't film here because you need a permit because it's the city, and you know, you gotta pay a tax to do it, and you can't get onto this land because it's owned by the government. And you know, you can't say this, it's dangerous, this government's going to get it taken off of YouTube. I mean, we've seen that a lot already. I think that I'm kind of intrigued with the Google Glass thing, you know, of the high def camera that's wearable. I think there's a lot of privacy concerns with it, which again basically go to the government, because I think the government is going to be spying on every frame of footage that's shot on those things. But I think that a high def wearable camera is a pretty revolutionary idea, because really, I mean, a film camera, movie making, if you think about the history of it, okay, when they first came up with movie cameras, you know, when Edison and the Lumiere brothers came out with film cameras, what did they film? The first thing they filmed were plays. Like, they had people act plays, basically. And even with silent movies, like, they had people acting like they did in plays, and they didn't move the camera. They just set the camera on a tripod and filmed the play. And then they realized, especially later when cameras got smaller, but even before they did, they realized, hey, wait, we can get up close in the actor's face. We can show over his shoulder. We can go places that the eye could never go if it was just watching a play. We can change the costuming. We can change the coloring. And it was kind of, you know, the camera became more than the human eye. And now, I mean, for the past 15, 20 years, cameras have done things that no camera could ever do, like, you know, with animation that looks ultra realistic, like go inside a human brain or go in from Earth to space in a second, and can do things that you could never do with a human eye or even a camera. And I think it's kind of interesting that it's going to go back to the camera being the eye, like being what your eye is seeing, and recording it in high def, even higher def than a human eye can see, than it can see on the spot. So I think that's one really interesting place it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of places it can go. You know, they used to say that whatever Hollywood has is with computers, whatever Hollywood has, we're 4 years away from having it at home. And, you know, Hollywood is going some pretty amazing places now with, you know, special effects and sci-fi stuff. I don't know, though. I think a story is always the most important thing, having something to say. And, you know, like there's big Hollywood movies now that I'm amazed by the effects, but the story is nothing special or almost non-existent. So I think we're going back to story. I think that's where I'd like to see it go, at least. We'll be back with more.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark. This is what radio sounds like now.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've been on the World Wide Web since its inception in 1994. I've tried dozens of web providers in that time. The only one that hasn't broken my heart is HostGator. HostGator has unlimited server space, unlimited throughput, and a guaranteed uptime of better than 99.9% for only $150 a year. You can pay a little less elsewhere, but you'll pull out your hair dealing with anyone else. HostGator has great service and unlimited tech support, only a phone call away, 24/7, 365. HostGator is where pros like the Fiends host, because we know how to do it right. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the HostGator affiliate link on the right sidebar to sign up today.
Right. This is Michael Dean, After Dark, and it's almost the end of the show. I'm being interviewed, and it's time for the denouement. Denouement. I'm not very French, so I can't say that right. It's actually the time for the redemption in the third act and the denouement. So what's your last question there, Andreas, about filmmaking?
Why should prospective DIY filmmakers make their own film? Why should they make a movie?
Well, because DIY filmmakers can't have someone else make their film, or they're not DIY filmmakers. But if the question is why should people make their own film instead of trying to go through the studio system, because through the studio system, your film will likely never get made. I would say you'd probably have better luck going to the horse track and gambling as a way to get success and money than doing it yourself. But if you want it done, if you want it done, you do it yourself. And a good parable for that for me is when I first moved to LA, you know, I knew a bunch of people that were trying to get into the Hollywood system. They were all writing screenplays or wanted to direct. And after 5 years of being there, they'd all left LA and gone back to Ohio or Kansas or New York or wherever they came from, and had not done anything with a film. And I had made a documentary and directed Robert Downey Jr. doing the narration that I'd written for my film. And I'd made a great movie that I was really proud of. And I'm still proud of it. People still like it. And it's a good film. And it's important in my life. And it's important in some other people's lives. So I consider that success. And I made some money on top of it. I don't consider money a measure of success, but it doesn't hurt, because it allows you to not have to deliver pizzas when you're making your art. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of people that I forgot to mention, and this ties into this when you said who are my influences. Robert Rodriguez, his book was a big influence, not his film. His films, the first one he made that was a big hit at Sundance, I forget what it's called. It's the
Mariachi.
Yeah. The one about the guy with the gun in his guitar case and mobsters chasing him and drugs and things. It's such a silly movie. It's really not even a good story. I mean, it's good for the genre it is, but it's not even an original genre. I mean, he's basically making a Mexican soap opera action movie. There were a million movies like that before, but none of them were made by one guy for, you know, a few thousand dollars on credit cards. They were all made by companies in Mexico. So, you know, he took an existing genre, and the only thing that was cool about it, the only reason people paid attention to it, was because he did it himself. So the film was not the story there. How he made it was the story. And I really liked his book. I read it. It was a big influence on me. And I was like, man, if this guy can do it, I can do it. And I think a lot of people did that too. But I skipped one of the things that he suggested. He suggested running up your credit cards. And I know a lot of people who read his book and ruined their life by running up their credit cards and thinking they'd have the same success he did. And they did not. And they ended up, you know, $50,000 in debt, and they're probably still paying it off 20 years later. I never borrowed money to make a film. I just made them as cheap as I could. I took donations. I asked friends for money. I asked a lot of people to do things for free. The most important thing I would say is, if you don't have money to pay people, make sure you feed them and make sure you credit them and make sure you give them a copy of the final thing. And make sure you get it in writing that you don't owe them money unless you're going to say you owe them money, because otherwise, one out of about 30 people will come back to you and say, "You owe me money." And you're like, "I didn't say I'd give you money." And they're like, "You owe me money." And the people that will come back and say you owe them money are always the least famous people and the least talented people and the people who did the very least on your film. You know, the movie star that you interview, he'll never come back and ask you for money. The successful band who's happy to be in another film, they'll never come back and ask you for money. You know, the guy who worked one day and broke your lights by accident and is on camera for 2 seconds, he'll come back and try to get your money. Thanks a lot, Andreas, for having me on. It's been a really good time, man.
Thank you for having me on.
Yep, absolutely.
This has been Michael Dean After Dark. I hope we've helped calm the hamster in your brain and left you in a better place than where we found you.
We'll be here 5 nights a week, same time and channel. In the meantime, go to michaelwdean.com for more. That's michaelwdean.com. Thank you and have a wonderful evening. Good night.